This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents North, Finding My Way While Running the Appalachian Trail. Written by Scott Jurek with Jenny Jurek. Read by Scott Jurek and Jenny Jurek. This program includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF. Dedication. For Jenny, my true north. Remote for detachment, narrow for chosen company, winding for leisure, lonely for contemplation. It beckons not merely north and south, but upward to the body, mind, and soul of man. Harold Allen, early Appalachian Trail planner.
Prologue. Day 7. Where is he? He should be here by now. He should have emerged from the sea of trees and met me at this road crossing more than an hour ago. It's been pouring all day, a bona fide deluge, and I'm not sure if he's twisted his ankle in the mud or taken a bad fall and is sitting on a rock waiting for me to find him. I call him Big Thump for a reason. He's constantly catching his size 11.5 feet on some root or rock, sending his 6'2" frame crashing to the ground with a resounding thud. Somehow, maybe thanks to his 25 years of trail running experience, he always manages to avoid serious injury. But maybe his luck has finally run out. I last saw him at a parting between two mountains, which out here in the deep south they call a gap. Being from the west, I had never heard the term before. What southerners call a gap is what I call a pass, and the French call a col, the lowest point of a ridge or a saddle between two peaks. At Sam's Gap, I noticed he had the slightest limp, but I shrugged it off because he started every morning stiff as a board until his muscles loosened up around midday. According to our calculations, he should be able to cover the 13.4 miles of trail to Spivey Gap in just over 3 hours. But what I've come to realize over the past 7 days is that every section is taking a lot longer than we expected, and that a steady pace of 4 miles an hour is surprisingly hard to maintain, even for him. On the Appalachian Trail, he goes by El Venado, Spanish for the deer. It's the spirit animal bestowed on him in the Copper Canyon by the late Caballo Blanco for the style of his running gait. But almost everyone knows him as Scott Jurek, one of the greatest ultramarathon runners ever, they say. To me, he's always been Jerker, starting way back in 2001 when we met in Seattle. That's what his friends called him, a play on his last name and a jab at his stereotypical Minnesotan niceness. He has accomplished things that no other male runner has even attempted, like winning the Western States 100-mile endurance run 7 years in a row. 1 year he sprained his ankle mid-race. 1 year he chased a bear up a tree. And 1 year, less than 2 weeks after he won, he set a course record at the Badwater 135. He ran laps on a 1 mile loop for 24 hours straight to set an American record. He won the Hard Rock 100 on a sprained ankle. And he holds 3 of the fastest times, behind only the great Giannis Kouros, in the 152-mile Spartathlon race. But now he's taking on a challenge that could permanently damage his body, not to mention our marriage. He said he wants this to be his masterpiece, but secretly, I wonder if he means it. Jerker, where are you?
Chapter 1. Give and take. A year earlier. No matter what direction I looked, I could see forever. And out past the place where forever ended, beyond the hazy horizon where sky and earth commingled, I knew the desert kept going. More rolling mountains, more vast valleys, more everything. West meant the Pacific Ocean and my old stomping ground in the Cascade Mountains outside Seattle. East meant my childhood home, back in the woods of Minnesota and beyond. South was more desert, more sun, more sand, less water. North, though, felt new again. Deserts have always been a mystifying and spiritual landscape for me. I didn't set foot in a desert until I was 22, and 2 decades later, deserts have retained their wonderful otherworldliness. I can see why many a spiritual seeker has chosen to walk through the desert for purification and reflection. The still and barren Anza Borrego Desert in Southern California could coax anyone toward enlightenment. As I marveled at the measure of eternity, I realized it was possible that I wasn't feeling enlightenment so much as mild heat mania. It was 95 degrees and only getting hotter. Almost every other living thing had taken refuge either below ground or in whatever meager shade could be found. The only creatures out and about were 2 bipedal mammals, hiding under portable shade, rhythmically striding along the trail. Many Pacific Crest Trail, PCT thru-hikers, take a break during the heat of the day, but we were short on time. We could get away from work and life for only a week, and we wanted to hike as much as possible. Light and smooth was the name of our game. Quick but easy. Desert hiking demands that you submit to paradoxes. You must move hastily through the sun and heat, yet slowly enough to avoid producing too much heat of your own. You need to ration the water you haul on your back, but not so much that you are burdened by its weight. Move too fast under the scorching sun, and you'll go through water so quickly that you'll wind up with dehydration and heat stroke. Carry too little water, and you'll shrivel up like a raisin, and the desert floor will swallow you whole. Out there, balance isn't just a beautiful idea. It's necessary for survival. It can also look silly. We were the wacky-looking, ultra-lightweight hikers, what Jenny calls outdoorky, wearing long-sleeved cotton shirts and hiding under umbrellas in the bone-dry heat. We were also carrying what could pass for day packs, each filled with only 20 pounds of gear, food, and water. We had stripped down to the bare essentials so that we could move efficiently, cover more miles, and enjoy them without being dragged down by huge packs. We had even left our camp stove at home. We rehydrated our meals while we hiked. I'd always dreamed of doing a long trail, of hiking for weeks and months on end with no specific schedule. I'd walk all day, camp where I wanted, live in the moment, feel the flow of unrestricted movement. I felt an urge to live close to the land and forget what society thought was normal. To transcend like Thoreau and Muir, with the Christopher McCandless ideals from Into the Wild, chasing a romantic goal, to move around, be nomadic, make each day a new horizon. I especially loved daydreaming about the ultralight hiking approach pioneered by Ray Jardine and outlined in his 1996 Bible on the subject, the Pacific Crest Trail Hiker's Handbook. Now 15 years after I first borrowed Jardine's guide from the Seattle Public Library, I was finally here, out on the PCT. It was everything I'd wanted. But I already wanted more. We hiked the trail in sections, a week at a time. So at this rate, it would take us about 20 years to finish the 2,600-mile trail. The more we hiked and hung out with the PCT thru-hikers, the more we both yearned to put our lives on hold for 3 months and keep walking all the way north. I turned around and looked south for my umbrella-carrying companion. Sometimes hours and miles passed without us talking. We didn't need to. We were immersed in the rhythm of our strides and in the wildness around us. Like the ancient Taoist philosophy, Wu Wei, we were doing without doing. More of that desert paradox. Often, we both did our own things, lost in our own thoughts or our own thoughtlessness, only to return to ourselves and suddenly strike up a conversation as if no time had passed. I loved it either way. I loved walking with her stride for stride, telling stories of our past, and passing the arduous miles with silly games, like quizzing each other on runners' nicknames and Instagram handles, and reciting movie dialogue and song lyrics. And then we would lapse into deep silence again, calmed by the desert. This was one of those times we were beating our PCT drums alone, separated by a quarter mile of mesquite bushes and sand. Her maiden name is Jennifer Lee Yuhisa, but I call her J-Lu, like her climbing buddies coined from her initials. She calls me Jerker. People sometimes can't believe we call each other by those casual nicknames that get hollered over canyons and campfires, but I think it's fitting. No sappy, lovey-dovey endearments, no traditional sweetie or dear. We are buddies to each other first and foremost. Sometimes adversaries, but always best friends, even through the deep canyons and high summits of life. We are a team, and we know each other better than anyone else on the planet knows us. Yuhisa is Japanese for perpetually rising or always up. The name fits. She's got a positive attitude no matter the situation, and like the desert sun, she's always rising. Hiking 20 miles a day with 20 pounds on your back isn't typically how people recover after emergency surgery. But J-Lu isn't your typical gal. Behind that cute, high-pitched voice is an absolute lion that roars past every challenge. I'm sure she inherited some of that strength from her family. Her Japanese grandparents lost their home and farm in California and were sent to internment camps during World War II. Her mother immigrated from the barangay of Manila to the United States at age 18. Nothing was handed to J-Lu, and the only thing she knew how to do was go out and earn things the old-fashioned way. That drive is what made our lives compatible. I always chuckle when people assume I turned J-Lu vegan and made her into an ultra-runner, because she became a vegetarian when she was 13, and she started running before I had ever met her. And she'll let people know it, too. I don't blame her. She has scratched and clawed her way through life, and she's done it with grace and wit. She's also got a hard edge, and that hard edge can be razor sharp. She comes across all sweet and nice, but she can hang with the toughest guys. She says that she isn't competitive, but watch out when it comes to table tennis, crossword puzzles, board games, card games, or really any game at all. And 2 months ago, she almost died in my arms. I'd never felt more helpless. In the middle of the night, I caught her when she passed out and held her when she vomited on our kitchen floor. She slipped in and out of consciousness as I pleaded with her, "Don't leave me now, don't leave me now." She didn't. Neither of us knew what was going on, so I drove her to the ER. After hours of testing and waiting, we finally had an answer. "You're pregnant," the ER doctor said. We sat in stunned silence. "But it's in the wrong place, so we need to terminate it." Unbeknownst to either of us, she was approximately 7 weeks pregnant, but the embryo had been growing in her left fallopian tube. When it got too big, it ruptured the tube, and now she was bleeding internally. After the diagnosis, everything went into hyperspeed. Before we knew it, she was signing liability waivers, being counseled on the potential risks of blood transfusions, and then getting wheeled into the operating room. I remember her in a semi-conscious state, asking the on-call OBGYN, "Will I be able to get pregnant again?" The doctor replied, "The next time you see me, I'll be delivering your baby." J-Lu half smiled and closed her eyes, and then they took her away. After hours of me pacing in the waiting room, she was back. We drove home at 6 o'clock the next morning and took stock of the damage. We'd lost a baby, but thankfully we still had each other. Never being one to take the easy route, she'd refused to let me carry the bulk of our gear on the trail, even though she was still recovering from surgery. At least I'd managed to convince her to let me carry all the water, and there were long stretches without water caches on the PCT. During thru-hiker season, local trail angels selflessly set out hundreds of gallons of water to make the Southern California desert sections slightly more hospitable. Otherwise, in drought years, 30 to 40-mile stretches without a drop of water would be commonplace. So would bodies, probably. As the mercury rose and heat waves rippled off the immediate horizon, my thoughts evaporated and drifted up and away from J-Lu. The desert, too, had its hard and soft parts, its own equilibrium. Scorching afternoon heat melted into cool, pink sunsets. The apparently lifeless landscape secretly teemed with radically adapted plants and animals. Back when I was an altar boy, I often heard people repeating the verse, "The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away." Back then, I understood it as a kind of observation. But out here in the desert, it felt more like a law than an observation. Giving and taking, a rule of existence that people often fail to acknowledge, except when out here in the marginal spaces, out where they're confronted by it. I welcomed the give and take of the desert. I welcomed what it required of me. Somewhere in between was balance, and nature always encouraged me to find that stability. What would water be without the arid desert floor? And what would lightness be without the weight? And maybe that's why Jaylu and I were out here. Maybe we were trying to chase that balance through the desert. I was free at that moment to contemplate the mysteries of the desert because we'd had a little flare-up a few miles back, and I needed the space. The good thing about the desert and the PCT is there is plenty of open space and miles of trail to let things calm down. It all started when she asked me the age-old question, "Where are you and where do you want to go?" Actually, it was more like, "What are you doing with your life?" It escalated a bit after she provoked me with, "I thought you were retired. Why do you keep saying you still have some races left? You always said you'd be done at 40. So why are you backpedaling? I'm tired of you spinning your wheels saying you're going to train for this race and that race. You say you have the drive, but I don't see it." So I made the mistake of going after her with, "Well, what are you doing with your career? I don't see you being the next Coco Chanel. I don't see you winning Project Runway." Of course she burst out laughing. What was I thinking, Project Runway? As if every designer's dream was to make it on a reality TV show. I'm never a match for her in these blowouts. She ate me alive the rest of the argument, and it ended in us screaming at each other in the middle of the solitude of the desert. It's not all peace and wu-wei. Part of the problem was that I knew what she meant. Maybe I was spinning my wheels. Maybe I'd convinced myself I wanted something I used to have. It's true that sometimes I felt washed up, and I vacillated between feeling content and feeling that I needed to do something more or be something more. I didn't know how much of this was my own personal yearning and how much was, frankly, keeping up appearances. Everyone wants the champ to continue winning. We all want our heroes to be immortal. We don't want to watch them slow down or become weaker. It was hard for me to deal with the incessant questions. What's next for you? So what race are you gearing up for? As Jaylu nudged me in the desert, "Maybe it's time to transition from athlete to ambassador, let go of the glory days. I can't watch you fake another half-hearted effort. It's not the jerker I know. Don't you want to be somebody?" How was it that she could see me better than I could see myself? And why did she have to drive me crazy in the process? I was fuming because she was right, and she was asking the right questions, exactly the kind that made me flail around mentally. My sensation of enlightenment dried up and fell away like some molted snakeskin. Later, I would be grateful to her. She was doing the thing that I loved her for, being a great partner, a challenging partner. She didn't just pat me on the back, stroke my ego, and tell me how amazing I was. Jaylu can give me tough love like no one else. That's not to say that I rushed back down the trail to thank her. All in good time. Besides, she really had kindled a line of thinking that was burning me up. Maybe racing and winning wasn't the challenge I needed right now, or ever again. If that was the case, I really didn't have a good answer to the question of what I wanted. What would come next? More trail for starters. We were a mere 20 miles through our planned 150-mile section, and I didn't want to finish. I just wanted to keep hiking toward forever. Jaylu made me realize I didn't know what I wanted next, but the desert reminded me what I wanted now. Give and take. I've always been fascinated with multi-day adventure runs and through hiking. As a kid in Minnesota, I never traveled beyond a handful of neighboring states, so I was in awe of people who rode their bikes along the shore of Lake Superior and of the cross-country cyclists I saw. Later, I heard stories about people walking and running across the country. The idea of powering myself across the country, an expanse that I could barely conceive of, was overwhelming. I vowed that I would do it someday, somehow. Then the rhythm and patterns of life got in the way. School, summer jobs, internships, college, work, grad school, more work. When I got into ultramarathoning, I read about the great Trans-American Foot Race, and of records being set on long national scenic trails, and on trails that cross famous landmarks and national parks. But then my new focus on ultra racing took over, and I promised myself I would do the multi-day and really long stuff toward the end of my career. And then, in 2003, on a run on this same trail, 2,200 miles north in the Cascade Mountains of Washington, I told my buddy David Horty Horton that I thought I was ready to tackle the speed record on the PCT. He said, "You were made for this, boy. But wait a little bit. Do some more racing. You have time. Let me do it first. Then you can break my record." That's old Horty for you. He's always got some half-sage advice to offer, with a little something in it for himself. He had already set a speed record on the Appalachian Trail earlier in his career, so he knew what he was talking about. I really didn't care when I did it. He was probably right. I had plenty of time to blow away whatever slow record he set on the PCT. Back then, I always had plenty of time left. I also couldn't forget what another veteran ultra buddy of mine, Rob Hollywood McNair, had told me when I was tempted to run the Trans-American Foot Race after listening to his stories. "Scotty, you run that race, and that'll be the last race you'll run," he said. "Stick to 50 and 100 milers." Now I knew what he meant. So maybe it was J.Lew that did it. Maybe it was her brutally honest reminder that my career was coming to a close. All of a sudden, I didn't have much time left. There weren't years stretching out in front of me, far-off days where I could stick a dream and wait for time to bring me to it. The only thing that stretched before me now was the rock and dirt and brush of the Anza Borrego. We had a week out here, but I wanted more. We had only started scratching the surface of our big life questions. I wanted more miles and a firm answer to, so what's next? One that didn't involve hemming and hawing and half-heartedness. I wanted to go back to those woods in Minnesota where I'd fallen in love with the idea of life-altering adventures and trails that went on forever. Suddenly, I also wanted to get out of the heat. It only took a few moments to piece together a plan. I would run one of the national scenic trails. There were three big ones, and we were on one of them, the PCT. We knew parts of it like the backs of our hands. The Continental Divide Trail, the longest, at 3,100 miles, followed the Rockies right through our new home state of Colorado, and it seemed like a good choice. But something about it didn't feel right. As soon as the idea came to me, it started to roll downhill and gather momentum. Why not try to beat the Appalachian Trail speed record? It was perfect. I wanted a completely new type of challenge, and I'd barely ever been on the trails east of the Mississippi. J.Lew was right. Ultramarathons weren't doing it for me anymore. After a hard 20 years of competing, that wasn't a surprise. But a speed record in the woods and mountains? A month-long adventure to crack myself open once again? I'd lost the passion to push my body and bend my mind to chew up miles in ultra races. But I still loved to run and explore my surroundings on foot. I loved being out here. Even the unfamiliarity attracted me. I instantly loved the idea of running somewhere totally new, totally unexplored, and totally unplanned. As my grandfather liked to tell me as we rambled over his back 40 acres in Wisconsin, the best way to know your land is to walk through it. Every twist and turn of the trail, every vista and boulder, and every road crossing and trailhead would be completely foreign to me. A new, undiscovered world around each corner. Of course, I wouldn't be rambling. I'd be chasing the speed record. Horty had done it years ago. I knew I could. Maybe it's what I needed to rekindle the flame that J.Lew had noticed dying out. Later on, I would work out the details, but my mind almost immediately started running through the calculations. I would run and hike an average of 50 miles or more a day for about 45 days along one of the most rugged trails on the planet. I would cover 2,189 miles while climbing and descending a million vertical feet. Over the course of about 6 weeks, I would cover the entire length of the Appalachian Trail faster than anyone before me. Well, I would attempt to. And I knew that I couldn't even begin to attempt it on my own. We'd preserved our post-fight silence for miles when I stopped on a switchback and let out the guttural craw of a raven. That's her trail name, Raven, like the color of her hair and the smartest birds around. Jaylu crawed back, and when she caught up, I blurted out my plan. I think I want to do the Appalachian Trail. Go after the record. It has lots of road crossings for you to meet me so we can hang out throughout the day. We can have lunches together, and you can run sections with me. It'll be a vacation, a fun adventure for both of us. Maybe if I kept talking, she wouldn't get a chance to say no. Jaylu stopped dead in her tracks with a look of dismay and a wince of confusion. She had heard me talk about speed records and through hiking, but that had been idle daydreaming. And there was a trail that was much closer to us than the Appalachian, a trail that we both loved. We'd lived in Seattle for years, so the Pacific Crest Trail felt like our backyard. I'd covered most of the trail in the state of Washington and parts of it in Oregon, and I'd run races on sections of it in California. Jaylu loved playing Find the Pacific Crest Trail Crossing with me as we made weekend road trips when we lived in Southern California. The PCT had been my home course, and then it became ours. The Appalachian Trail? Jaylu said with a look that I knew all too well. Why? Then there was silence, a deafening silence that even the eternally still Anza Borrego Desert couldn't match. Because I'm stuck. Because I'm 40 and I need to feel what it's like to go to the edge again and then go farther. Because I'm so thankful for everything I have, and just for a little while I need to remember what it feels like to have none of it.
May 2015. Before I agreed to go on this trip, a Majorker promised me that we would rehearse. Not for him, all he had to do was run, but for me. I was the one who was going to have to drive a van to remote meeting locations and serve as a roving aid station several times a day. Even though I had plenty of experience, I was worried. I had been running ultramarathons for 13 years, including 2 100-mile mountain races, so I knew what kind of logistics were involved. But this wasn't a race or an event. It was more of a multi-week vision quest than anything else, and it was going to be much more complicated than anything either of us had done before. So I wanted to practice. That didn't happen. It wasn't really Jerker's fault, or anyone's fault for that matter. I'd had my second miscarriage in April, right when we were supposed to be on a 3-day trial run on the Arizona Trail, and then DNC surgery on April 30th, 9 days before we were scheduled to pick up our cargo van in Chicago. We had hoped to buy the van a month earlier, but given the added medical bills, the refinancing on our house took longer than we'd anticipated. Setbacks, not deal breakers, but they left us scrambling to put all the pieces in place, and there was no time for a rehearsal. Our departure date grew closer, and we were not only way behind schedule, but also way underprepared. Every Appalachian Trail record holder had hiked the entire trail, or at least significant sections of it, before starting his or her fastest known time, FKT, attempt. We'd never even been to half of the 14 states it crossed. Nevertheless, I can't claim that we were complete AT newbies. A few years ago, Scott was speaking at a running event in Pennsylvania near an AT crossing, so we drove the rental car to the trail. We ran out 3 miles and back. Those 3 miles, 0.14% of the trail, were the entirety of my Appalachian Trail knowledge. I was worried. Jerker wasn't. He didn't seem to feel the pressure of our prep time running out. He wasn't cranking out spreadsheets or studying previous record holder splits. He wasn't obsessively checking the blogs and trip reports of past attempts. Then again, even if he'd wanted to, he couldn't. The most recent supported attempts had all been southbound. We were going north. It would be a completely different run. The extent of Scott's planning boiled down to this. He made one single-sided spreadsheet with approximate daily mileage, bought the AT Guide, a handbook for hiking the Appalachian Trail, northbound 2015, and called it a day. I bit my tongue. To be honest, our lack of logistical planning didn't worry me as much as Jerker's indifference to physical training did. He wasn't out running long back-to-back days in the mountains with a heavy pack like he'd said he would. He also hadn't hired a strength coach or done any overnights on the trail. But whenever I grilled him about training, he gave me the same answer. 20 years of ultramarathon racing is my training. I couldn't argue with that. My version of training is casual. I mostly run solo with my iPod full of hip-hop and electronic tunes. Sometimes I run with friends, but always without a watch. Once, after missing a Boston Marathon qualifying time by 2 minutes, I asked Jerker in frustration, "Why can't I run fast?" He said, "You can, but you don't like to hurt," which is absolutely true. I prefer to run with ease, and it means I've never dropped from a race, even if I've never won one. I'd seen Jerker drop, or nearly drop, from 7 big ones over the past 6 years. He always gave the same reason, one that I didn't recognize. His heart wasn't in it. Well, it had better be this time. I wasn't going to give up my spring and summer for some half-hearted effort, and I knew what it looked like when he faked it. The Leadville Trail in 2013 was a perfect example. He'd convinced himself that this was going to be his big comeback, that he would win this race that was steeped in ultra-running folklore, a race in which he'd finished second 10 years prior. And he went through the motions. He looked the part, said the right things, did everything to a T. Everything except the running. I'm not sure if he was banking on muscle memory or if he was planning to will himself to the podium, but he just didn't compete. Even I could tell that much. On race day, he looked like he was struggling just to stay in the top 10. And then, finally, when he'd had about 20 miles to go, I saw him give up. He didn't fake an injury. He didn't drop out. I just saw him relax. He stopped fighting. He was running like I do, running with ease. I guess he didn't want to hurt anymore. With 3 miles to go, he was jogging it in. But when the finish line came in view, he perked up and yelled, "Jalu, run with me. Let's run it in together." I cringed. I was embarrassed for him, but how could I tell him that? Yes, I was proud of him for finishing, proud of him for cheering the runners who passed him, but I was sad for him, too. I knew this wasn't what he was looking for. At the finish area, Jerker hung around and chatted with everybody, seemingly unfazed to take the L. Maybe he was getting used to losing, or maybe it no longer mattered to him. Jerker actually seemed happy. I'm not as gracious or as nice as Jerker. I wanted to get out of there as soon as possible. I've known Jerker for 15 years, and he's always been that way. Extra nice. I moved to Seattle on March 26, 2000. I remember the date because it was the day the kingdom imploded and everybody was in a kind of civic mourning. I had never been into running, but since I didn't know a single soul in town, I started doing local 5-kilometer races in hopes of meeting people. Scott worked at my local running store, the Seattle Running Company, and even at the height of his career, he was so approachable that I didn't realize he was a celebrity in some circles. I remember seeing him after I finished my first half marathon. He congratulated me as if I'd run an Olympic qualifying time. I caught the running bug and 2 years later ran my first 50-kilometer ultramarathon. My main training buddy was a guy named Charlie, who was also a friend of Jerker's. In 2004, Charlie decided to run the Western States 100-mile endurance run, and I volunteered to crew and pace him. Around 38 miles before the finish line, we heard that Jerker had won the race and broken the course record. At the award ceremony, people swarmed over Scott, and someone asked, "How long do you want to keep doing this?" It was his 6th consecutive win. He was on top of the world. To this day, I remember his answer. It was immediate and confident. He said, "There are still a few things I want to do, but I won't be doing this forever. I'm going to retire by the time I turn 40. Now, at 41, he wasn't so confident anymore. I heard it in his voice, saw it in his manner. When people asked him if he was done racing, he got defensive. 11 years ago, he was planning on hanging it up at this point, but now it seemed like he was having a hard time letting go. I got it. He'd built his whole career winning races around the world, but he'd always told me he looked forward to sleeping in, to slowing down, and spending more time at home. So what was he trying to prove on the Appalachian Trail? I didn't have time to ponder that question. We had less than 2 weeks to convert our black cargo van, which we named Castle Black, into something we could live in, and then we had to load it up with everything we might need for 2,189 miles of running. An electrician installed a 200-watt solar panel on the roof. We made a bed frame and threw a twin-size foam mattress on it. Scott made a small tabletop for the gas camping stove. I sewed blackout curtains. There was no time to install a fan or windows. I cut out pieces of reflective bubble wrap and duct taped them to the walls for insulation. We bolted down 6 low-budget shelving racks for storage. We transformed those 60 square feet of bare metal into a home on wheels, kind of. To me, the sooner we left, the better. I had RSVP'd yes to a friend's wedding in South Carolina on May 23rd. Jerker had insisted we go. He knew how much it meant to me, and he promised we would make it on time. We worked on the van around the clock, and it seemed to rain around the clock. It was one of the wettest Mays on record in Boulder. We couldn't build our bed frame in the rain. The first time it let up was at 11 o'clock one night. I didn't want to wake the neighbors, but time was running out, so we drilled and sanded into the wee hours of the next day. The longer we stayed home, the more Jerker overpacked. Every day he dug up dusty old gear from our garage and loaded it in the van. "Should I pack these mosquito head nets? Better bring them just in case." 2 minutes later, "Do we need this cast iron griddle? What if you want to make me pancakes? Better bring it." "Are you seriously packing 20 pairs of socks?" I asked. "Jehu, do you understand that my feet are the most important thing out there? I have to keep them dry." I rolled my eyes and removed 10 pairs when he wasn't looking. The timing was stressful, but the work was fun, and it took my mind off the things I was looking forward to leaving behind in Boulder. The pain, the frustration, the needles, the doctors, the surgeries. Friends stopped by to help with the van build-out, and we often stayed up until 2 in the morning getting everything dialed in. One afternoon, my phone rang, but my hands were covered in duct tape, so I didn't answer. My friend Timmy O'Neill left a message. "Jalu, bad news from the valley. Dean Potter died yesterday." I crumpled to the floor. Dead? I had just talked to him 10 days ago. We'd had plans to visit him in Yosemite in April, but my miscarriage had gotten in the way. I was devastated. Dean had lived far out on the edge, so perhaps it seems naive that I was shocked by his death. He was a master of the dark arts, devoting almost 3 decades to a series of high-risk, all-or-nothing pursuits, like free solo climbing some of the most towering, difficult rock faces without a rope or partner, and wingsuit flying, where he leapt from those same overhanging walls and glided not only downward, but also as close as possible to the rocks he aimed to avoid. Contrary to having a death wish, he sought to push himself to and through the impossible. He was the most meticulously precise and calculated guy I'd ever known, even more than Jerker. Razor-focused with a bird's-eye detail for everything, Dean was the dark wizard, in tune with the wind, wildlife, and the trees, and the last person I'd expected to die. Suddenly, our adventure made much more sense, and I felt an urgency to disappear into the mountains. That's where Jerker and I go when we need to clear our heads, to reprioritize and re-examine our lives. I was still concerned about being underprepared, but now I couldn't wait to get in Castle Black and drive east. We locked up the house and pulled out of our driveway at 1:20 a.m. on May 23rd. My friend was getting married in 15 hours. I'd been giving Jerker the stink eye for days. He knew we were late and offered to drive through the night on the off chance that we might make it there in time. I tried to act mad, but I was too excited. I queued up my power song, cranked the volume, and woke the neighbors one last time. We were finally on our way.
Deep South, 465 miles. What is straight? A line can be straight, or a street. But the human heart? Oh, no. It's curved like a road through mountains. Tennessee Williams, A Streetcar Named Desire. Chapter 2. Live What You Love. May 24th. Vast open plains rip by us at 70 miles an hour. As Boulder, home, and the Rockies sank into the horizon behind us, our worries and disappointments seemed to recede as well. We were finally on the road, and that road would eventually become a trail. But first, we had to drive across half of the United States. Heading east from the center of the country is one long downhill ride. The Martian-looking sand dunes of eastern Colorado fade into the rolling fields of Kansas, and then turn into the flatlands by the mighty Mississippi. It's land made for road trips, and I loved it, even though I was already exhausted. In a bit of worrying foreshadowing, we'd hit the road a lot later than we'd wanted to. Actually, it was early. Very early. And after a couple of hours on I-70, we pulled over at a truck stop to sleep. Unfortunately, our undisciplined start time meant that we were going to miss our first goal. I'd promised Jaylu that we'd make a detour to her friend's wedding in South Carolina. We were already too far behind schedule to do that. Besides, we probably would have fallen asleep during the ceremony. The past 2 weeks had been sleepless while we rushed to make sure the van was ready and to prepare for the drive. So we were 0 for 1 on the goal list. However, we were still on track for our ultimate destination and schedule. And better yet, we were on the open road. Sharing the American love affair for long, unbroken stretches of pavement and mile markers, I loved seeing the country unfold and deepen as we headed east. I yearned for that feeling of being in between, no longer rooted at home and not yet fastened to the destination. Both physically and spiritually loosened. Like Kerouac, nothing behind me, everything ahead of me, as is ever so on the road. I was in road trip in heaven. Then the phone rang. Jaylu glanced at my phone and said, "Speed Goat," not disguising the anxiety in her voice. I didn't even need all the fingers on one hand to count the number of times Carl, Speed Goat Meltzer, had called me over the years. It was hard for me to imagine him using a phone or even owning a cell phone. It meant only one possible thing. He'd found out. How had he found out? I better answer, put him on the speaker. Jaylu fiddled with the phone and the new radio system we'd installed in the van, a concession I'd happily made for her entertainment on what would likely be long, lonely stretches of driving. And suddenly, Carl was there with us.
"Dude, why didn't you tell me?"
I respect Carl. I admire him. We're longtime running buddies, but also fierce competitors. I think the Speed Goat has been good for the sport, an old-school legend who isn't afraid to follow his own playbook. Nobody has won more 100-milers than the Goat, but I was hesitant to hear his thoughts on my trail attempt. I focused on the road and let his question linger against the hum of the freeway.
"Okay," he said. "First of all, you're going backward. Why the hell are you going north?"
Here we go. Carl had run the Appalachian Trail before. He'd taken 2 cracks at the speed record, to be precise, and had been on countless missions to recon the twisted path. He knew it way better than I did. That was indisputable. But I didn't want to go in having studied the Cliff's Notes. I didn't want to get schooled or steal unearned beta. I wanted challenge. I wanted adventure. And, yeah, against my better judgment, I wanted to run north. I didn't worry that the current record was set going south, and that nearly all the other recent records and attempts were too. I knew I was running in an arguably slower direction. Carl was going to tell me I was doing it wrong right from the beginning. And he wasn't incorrect. He had a lifetime of knowledge and experience with the trail. He'd have facts, figures, stories. The only rationale I could offer for running north was almost embarrassingly whimsical. I wanted to run with the spring, the way most thru-hikers do, the way the visionary Earl, the crazy one Schaefer, did in 1948, becoming the first person to continuously hike the AT. He penned a memoir about it, Walking with Spring. I was worried that if I admitted that out loud, it might sound like I was attempting the FKT without 100% laser focus. Maybe aesthetic pleasure was not a sound rationale. Was I screwed before I'd even started? Luckily, Carl had other things to talk about, namely all things AT. He yapped on like an excited puppy. I love that about the Speed Goat. The AT was his baby. And pretty soon he was promising to come out in a couple weeks and help Jenny crew in Virginia. He had an ulterior motive. He wanted to do some recon for his own record attempt next year, and he needed to drive his van out to the East Coast so it'd be ready for a 500-mile training run from Katahdin to Mount Washington. Southbound, of course. J-Lew and I had set out on an adventure for the two of us. We had these romantic ideas about supporting each other, about hacking our way north without anyone else's help, rediscovering the very best in each other. But we were already behind schedule and taking on extras. In Tennessee, we pulled over where the AT crossed I-40. We ran on that southbound, stretching our legs from the drive, knowing we would be retracing those steps in just a few days. I got back in the van and made one more phone call to Jennifer Farr Davis. When she set the current AT speed record in 2011, I was immensely impressed. I knew she was one of the strongest thru-hikers out there, and she didn't run a single step during her attempt. I respected her record, and I wanted her to know. She left a voicemail in return saying, "The Appalachian Trail is very different than a lot of other places," adding that she hoped we'd have a really transformative experience out there, and wishing us all the best. I didn't ruminate on the way her voice hung on the words different and transformative, but I knew she'd been through the fire. On May 25th, we pulled into Georgia. The run was 2 days away, and things hadn't yet stopped going wrong. This time it wasn't my fault. The weather in Georgia was absolutely possessed. High winds and a drenching downpour. For some reason, I'd been imagining a sort of temperate, pleasant atmosphere in the south. As a Midwest kid, I assumed it was easier living in the southern part of the country. Instead, the forecasts were for tornadoes and flash floods on what was supposed to be day one. The weather also meant that our good friend and adventure photographer, Luis El Coyote Escobar, was delayed getting in. Luis, who had been running ultras since 1990, was joining us for the first few days. He'd be shooting pics while he ran and hiked with me for sections. He was flying in from California, but his ETA kept getting pushed back due to flight delays and local Atlanta weather. Finally, he made it. Kind of. He arrived late at night, and J-Lew and I had to go pick him up at an ad hoc meeting location, a parking lot outside the Whole Foods in Duluth, Georgia. We drove in, and there, stepping out of the cab, was Luis, utterly drenched already, and leaning into the gale at about 45 degrees just to stay on his feet. He was lugging a backpack that looked like it was fit for an Everest attempt. I wondered if he knew something we didn't. Wind lashed and soaked to the bone, Luis looked defeated. Yet he was totally unfazed. Typical El Coyote. "Amigo, I wasn't going to miss this. Whenever you call, man, I know it's going to be something good and crazy." He was game for anything. In his early 50s, he had a youthfulness that could rival the high schoolers he coached and the 20-somethings he hung out with. He always said that ultra running kept him young. That and his spunky wife of 30-plus years. As he says, "I'm the gas, she's the brakes. And from what I've seen, she doesn't pump them too often. I invited him down to the Copper Canyon with me in 2006 to chase the legendary Tarahumaran runners. Whenever we traveled internationally together, we had to allow for extra airport time because his last name, one shared with a certain Colombian drug lord, always seemed to trigger additional security screening. But this time, we were taking a bus. On our 12-hour ride back to El Paso, Texas, the bus broke down and we had to pile into another dilapidated bus that was already full. I sat on the floor between the seats with the rest of our group, but El Coyote climbed into the grimy overhead luggage rack and stretched out. For the next 6 hours, Luis knew how to take a beatdown. He was tough as nails, but he knew something that was more important. El Coyote had the ability to laugh when he wanted to cry, the secret to longevity in ultra running. He had brought his own camping gear, but the rain was still relentless when we finally got back to the campground. So we invited him to spend the night inside the van if he could fit. He found a way. We had planned to make the 24 hours before day one a total rest day, a time for sleeping as much as possible. But that night, Jenny and I huddled together in our little mobile headquarters next to poor El Coyote, who lay crammed and contorted between cans of vegan chili, resting his head on a pillow of powdered coconut milk. Castle Black hardly felt like a fortress as it shook in the gale. Rain slashed against the roof, branches scratched at the sides, the night stretched on, and we decided to postpone day one. When we woke up the next morning, we knew it had been the right decision. The skies were still dark, the wind was still Wizard of Ozing around, and conditions were discouraging. We hunted down a place where we could fill our brand new mini propane tank. We'd rely on that to make warm meals, and if the weather was going to stay like this, I was going to crave comforts at the end of each long, wet day. We checked out the AT Southern Terminus trailhead, hiked a mile to Springer Mountain, and sampled some Southern culture in the form of boiled peanuts purchased at a roadside stand. My spirits were rising. I liked the South already and regretted that I wouldn't get to experience more of it. We decided to have a last supper together with Luis and an independent film crew that was going to follow us for a few days to shoot a documentary about vegan athletes. We all met in the lobby of the lodge at Amicalola Falls State Park, and I found myself standing beneath a giant wall map of the Appalachian Trail. A bit of regional decor. The lodge held the last modern amenities that giddy thru-hikers would see before setting off on their 2,000-mile journey. That map made me both nervous and excited at the same time. I tried to catch Jaylu's eye, but she was staring up at it, her neck craned to take in the whole 30 feet of the map. I could tell she was a little freaked out, too. It looked like a map of the world, or of Middle Earth. It looked huge. I wondered if the lodge staff was trying to have some fun with the eager thru-hikers, giving them a little, abandon hope, all ye who enter here, thrill. What it did to Jaylu and me was make us actually come to terms with the sheer scale of what we are about to do. From our perch in Boulder, scribbling notes, looking at maps online, reading books, it had been easy for us to miniaturize and modelize the attempt. No longer. We were really here. And as I looked up at that map, in some way, it put fear in my bones. Nothing about the map, or the Appalachian Trail itself, invited even the contemplation of speed. For starters, there's the magnitude of it. Say you started your journey at the northernmost point of the trail, the summit of Katahdin, Maine. And in a stroke of spectacular miscalculation, you tacked northeast instead of following the white blazes south. If you traveled the same distance as the Appalachian Trail spans, you would find yourself on the outskirts of Reykjavik. The AT is 2,189 miles long, the distance from Los Angeles to Atlanta. It would wind halfway around Pluto. And of those intimidating 2,189 miles, I had been on a mere 20 of them. A handful of miles in Vermont, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, less than 1% of the entire trail. Even with my vast experience running roads and trails around the world, the data was daunting. Imagine running 84 marathons, consecutively, over the gnarliest and oldest mountains in the world. It follows the spine of the Appalachians, peaks once rivaling the towering summits of the Himalayas, now ground down by geologic millennia. The Pacific Crest Trail, at 2,650 miles, is longer than the AT, and the Continental Divide Trail, at 3,100, is longer still. And while a lot of Westerners boast about the snowpacks and deserts, the granite outcroppings, the alpine meadows, and the oxygen-sucking heights, the fact is that if you're fit, it's a comparatively smooth ride. The Western trails have their frozen passes and jagged peaks, but most miles were graded for horseback travel, and their switchbacks rarely climb at anything steeper than a 10% grade. As a foot-travel-only path, the AT is much sneakier and more devilish. It dives directly into ravines. It snakes into foggy river bottoms and then shoots straight up hills so dense with undergrowth that even deer have trouble climbing them. It is almost hard to describe it until you actually set foot on the AT's potpourri of rocks and roots. The tread and grade are like tentacles that grab at you from different directions when you least expect it, making forward progress a tedious and tense battle. On top of that twisted floor are walls of woods and a ceiling of tree limbs that are challenging in their own right. The Appalachian Trail is so wooded and thick, so dense and enclosed, that it is known as the Green Tunnel. Which hadn't sounded so bad back when we were first toying with the idea at home. A tunnel sounded nice, an escape from miscarriages and the failure to start a family. A chance to focus on just one thing, to do something hard. To get away from a warm bed and pancake sundaes, and a life that I loved, but that had ceased to be enough for me. I think we all assume that we'll chafe against conformity and settling in our lives. But settling isn't dangerous because it's unpleasant. The real danger was that I was beginning to like it. Jaylu saw it too. She knew how comfortable I had become. She wanted a new challenge for both of us. Still, standing under a 3-story map of the AT labyrinth as wind and rain howled outside, we couldn't help wondering if we had been a little hasty in picking this particular challenge. The next morning, May 27th, 2015, the alarm startled me. Not because it was loud, but because I was surprised I'd actually fallen asleep the night before. The rain had been pounding the van incessantly, and because we didn't have time to properly insulate the roof before we left Boulder, each drop seemed to land like an open-handed slap across the thin sheet of metal 3 feet above my face. It wasn't just noisy in there, it was cramped too. Jaylu and I were used to tight fits, but somehow the twin bed that we shared normally without issue seemed to shrink in the humidity. Then there was Luis. He was curled up on the 5-foot patch of floor we'd cleared for him. If he hadn't been snoring, I might have squished him when I hopped out of bed. El Coyote stacked a few boxes of coconut milk to make a chair, and the three of us drove to the trailhead in the dark. It was silent in the van. The winding road seemed endless in the rain, and we were all tired and nervous. There were still so many unknowns. Sometimes you have to go backward to go forward. We stepped onto the trail and hiked southbound to Springer Mountain, the shortest way to access the southern terminus. Fog was swirling around the viewless summit, and rocks were greasy with a mixture of rain, mud, and humidity. But there was no more postponing. And I knew that I could expect to see plenty more of this kind of weather over the next 40-odd days. We couldn't wait for perfect conditions. From the very beginning, Jaylu and I had been moving forward only semi-prepared. No reason to start being cautious now. It was time. We turned on our headlamps and signed the summit logbook. I wrote, "On one of the biggest adventures of my life, Georgia to Maine, Scott Elvinato Jurek." And Jaylu wrote, "Live what you love, Jenny Raven Jurek." I made a few last-minute adjustments. I tinkered with the GPS tracker and my watch. We firmed up plans to meet Luis, who would drive the van that morning, so I could run with Jaylu. We hugged each other, and then I said,